beat the Pirates 8-6. White Sox lose to Cleveland 7-3. A couple of day games today. The Brewers and Cardinals at Miller Park. The White Sox play in Cleveland. Then tonight, Cubs play the Pirates again in Pittsburgh. The Kenosha Kingfish won their season home opener last night against Battle Creek 7-6. They meet again tonight at Simmons Field at 6:35. Stanley Cup Series. Washington plays in Las Vegas tonight. The Vegas Golden Knights are leading the Capitals 1-0. In that series. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Periods of showers, thunderstorms, and fog throughout the day. Some of those storms could produce heavy rainfall. Today's high 79, inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Looking at the radar, all the rain is well to our west and moving in a northwesterly direction. Nothing near us at all at this point. 69 degrees in Racine, 68 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show will be spent dealing with a very dark and terrifying moment in world history. And the title of this book really says it all, Chernobyl, the history of a nuclear catastrophe. I want to begin with a brief personal story. I vividly remember when and how I heard the news about Chernobyl. I was on my way out of the city of Chicago, moving back home. My father was driving, I was in the passenger seat, and over the radio came a report from CBS Radio News, the voice of Dan Rather, and basically the story said, something has happened, we don't know what, but high radiation levels have been detected in the nation of Sweden. And at that point, nothing specific was known at all, but just hearing those words was among the most frightening moments I can ever remember. And I know many others in the West were equally frightened by the news that some kind of nuclear event somewhere had occurred. And of course, eventually it became clear that something had happened at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Soviet Ukraine. And now we know a fair amount about what unfolded there, but never has so much information been gathered together as it has in this meticulously researched book by my guest today, Serhii Plokhii, who is a professor of Ukrainian history and director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. He has a number of different books to his credit, including Lost Kingdom, The Gates of Europe, The Last Empire, The Cossack Myth, Yalta. And again, this most recent book published by Basic Books is titled Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. And I'm honored indeed to be able to speak with Professor Plokhii for the next few minutes about this astonishing book. Professor Serhii Plokhii, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. And I was listening to your introduction and was thinking about when and how I heard first about Chernobyl. And it's a very, very different story in a sense that the Soviet government, of course, was hiding information from us. When 3 days after the accident, finally some information was released, it was just about a routine accident. And again, that cover-up that was there is a very big part of the story that I am telling in the book.
Absolutely. And of course, one thing that is especially interesting to think about is how this catastrophe, and a catastrophe it was on several different levels, in many respects, you believe, directly led to the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yes. This is one of the arguments that I'm making in the book. And sometimes people talk about Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, comparing it to U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and saying that that was one of the reasons that eventually led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in comparison to Afghanistan, Chernobyl is a much, much bigger factor. The reason for that was that eventually there was a revolt in Ukraine, in Lithuania, in other parts of the Soviet Union against the government that was hiding information from its own people, the information on which life and death really depended, whether people would go healthy or people could eat and consume all sorts of affected by radiation food and water. So in Ukraine, the republic that was really whose decisions were crucial for the continuation of the Soviet Union, the revolt against the center started with Chernobyl, and the same is true for Lithuania, the first Soviet republic that declared its independence in March of 1990, so a year and a half before the collapse of the Soviet Union. There, the mobilization was taking place after Chernobyl against a nuclear power plant that existed at that time in Lithuania and was viewed as kind of an imperial encroachment on Lithuania, given what happened in Chernobyl, when again the central government was hiding information.
In the preface of the book, which includes your account of actually visiting Chernobyl, of course many years after the fact, after this accident, you mention at one point that you wrote this book both as a historian and as a contemporary of the events being discussed. Explain what kind of difference that perhaps made. First of all, explain what you exactly mean by that and what kind of difference you think it made in the way this book was written versus a book that might have been written by someone who was only a historian with absolutely no sense of direct connection to what happened at Chernobyl.
Well, I believe that my personal experiences of someone who was living at that time around the Chernobyl allow me to see maybe in the documents and the testimonies that are there something that people who didn't have that experience have difficulty seeing. Again, I start with that description of my trip to the exclusion zone. It was a few years ago, and we got a wonderful local guide who had all the facts, all the basic facts about what happened in Chernobyl and how it happened, but she really was a young person. She didn't live through those times. She lacked context. And she couldn't understand some basic things about the life of people in the city of Pripyat, which is now abandoned. And it was then that I decided, okay, actually, I know that. I have this experience that it's very difficult to get just by reading books, and I should use it. It's also emotional kind of attachment to people, to circumstances. I mention in the book that two of my classmates, they ended up in the exclusion zone working there after the explosion. My own family was affected in a way that I had small children at that time, and we had to lock them in our apartment for almost the entirety of the summer because we were afraid that the fallout from Chernobyl can affect them. And indeed, later it became known that there was a huge spike in the cases of thyroid cancer among children in particular, between 4,000 and 6,000 cases that wouldn't happen otherwise. So that was something in terms of the knowledge of the circumstances, but also emotional attachment that I had in that book, right in that book, that something that I didn't have with others. And at the end, I think it helped to produce a better book, where the archival sources that I uncovered really speak to the reader with human voices.
Before we begin exploring the details of your book, I wonder if you could just describe a little bit about the experience of visiting first the 30-mile exclusion zone, and then the even more restricted 10-mile exclusion zone, and eventually reaching Chernobyl itself. What did you ultimately end up seeing, and what kind of safeguards were taken to ensure your safety? And even with those safeguards, was it frightening to return to the site of such devastation, a place which is still in so many ways a very dangerous place to be?
Well, it was frightening, but then you kind of think that the exclusion zone is also the place where there are hundreds and thousands of people work today constructing the new shelter over the damaged reactor. It's an international multi-billion project. And you think, okay, if they are there and if they find the way to do that despite all sorts of delays caused by the still high radiation levels, then probably you could do that as well. And they gave you counters, and it's really very interesting when the counters are silent, but then you enter certain areas, and they start just going and beeping like crazy. The guide suggested to us that we would take our counters and put them next to the place where the water was coming from the roof. So that means that's where most of contamination was going. And indeed, those counters were just starting beeping. Then we moved closer to the, really, we're at the very center near the reactors where the construction work is going on. And the counters were really very, very loud. And the guide told us, okay, just switch them off. and we saw, okay, there are people out there, they're working. So I don't know exactly on what level the counters were set, but that's what we did. And I write in the book that that's also what quite often people who dealt with that disaster did. At the end, the guide told us, and I believe that this is the case, that we didn't get in one day in the zone more exposure to radiation than we get on transatlantic flight. But again, you still think whether this is the case or not. I believe it is safe. It is perfectly safe now to go to some areas in the exclusion zone, not to all areas. But you still have this kind of a scary feeling. Mm. How safe it is it?
Right. What were the most valuable resources to which you could turn to unlock so much information about what happened at Chernobyl? I'm staggered that you are able to describe this event in such great detail. Where is most of this kind of information housed? Or were you speaking with some of the direct participants? I mean, what kind of resources proved most valuable for you?
Well, the two key sets of evidence, I would say, were the most important for my book. So one were the really human stories. And a lot of that was already done by people who were there immediately after the explosion. There were books published by which were testimonies of people including by Svetlana Alexievich, Nobel Prize winning writer. And it's interesting that this particular type of interviews of hers were treated as really literature and a wonderful good example of literature that was worth a Nobel Prize. But the problem was that, okay, all these individual stories, they were hanging out somewhere. It wasn't clear how that would fit the entire big picture of the explosion and the aftermath and the impact that it had on the society. So that was really my task, to take those voices and integrate them into a bigger picture that would actually explain what happened, what the lessons can be. Another set of sources were of a different kind. Those were archival sources. And I was really lucky in terms of when I was working on that book that a lot of my archival research happened in the last few years after the Maidan protests and the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine. So this the ouster of the authoritarian regime of President Yanukovych. And one of the things that revolution led to was, I call it the archival revolution, the unprecedented opening of the state archives, including the archives of the KGB. And it's from there that I got a lot of really very fresh and new information that wasn't available to either journalists or to writers or to historians who worked on the topic before that. And again, it's from the minutes of the state commission that dealt with the issues of trying to figure out whether the level of radioactive poisoning of the water in the Dnieper, for example, was high enough to really cause some very drastic measures, for example, like resettlement of the entire villages or cities, or what was happening with the milk that came from the cows that were eating grass, which was highly contaminated. What do you do with the people from exclusion zone, where you resettle them? So that's one set of documents, and then there would be KGB, and KGB was kind of a good and bad guys at the same time in that story. On the one hand, they were reporting on all sorts of violations of the safety procedures at the nuclear plant before the explosion. And then once the explosion took place, they were there to cut the telephone lines to the city, so they were in control of the information, and they were the ones who were not allowing the information to spread anywhere in the Soviet Union or outside of its borders. Mm-hmm. Those were the people who were involved in following and surveillance of the foreign reporters that were coming to the area, including from National Geographic. And now we have access to those reports.
Right. That's actually a very interesting chapter in the book. Towards the end of the book, the title of it is Writer's Block. And it is an account of the Soviet government's attempts, at least, to try to control the kind of things that were written about Chernobyl when it started to become impossible to, in a sense, keep the prying eyes of the West out from investigating it. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Serhii Plokhii, author of an astonishing book called Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. We are talking about an event that occurred back in April of 1986, essentially the worst nuclear disaster in history, an explosion at Chernobyl, which you'd say in your book was the equivalent of 500 Hiroshima bombs, and it was a devastating disaster on many, many levels. I appreciate, Professor Plokhii, that you give us some rich historical context to the accident, and it appears from what you write that one of the key factors was a ramping up of efforts by the Soviet government to shift the attention of the military-industrial complex into the economic sphere to really make things happen, and in particular to increase the production of electricity at nuclear power stations at an astonishing and, of course, we know now, ultimately dangerous sort of rate. Explain what was going on there and the connection that that move perhaps has with what happened at Chernobyl.
You're absolutely right that Chernobyl happened at the time when the Soviet government was trying really to revive the economy that was really almost in a free fall. It happened in 1986. That was just 1 year after a relatively young and very ambitious Soviet leader was elected. His name was Mikhail Gorbachev. But it was before all sorts of drastic reforms, both political, social, economic, were started. At that time, in 85-86, Gorbachev still believed that the Soviet system was basically sound. The only thing what was needed was to find those reserves that were already allegedly there. And the belief was that miracles could be done by using really science, and nuclear power from that point of view was the key element of Gorbachev's thinking. The term that they were using at that time was acceleration. So the idea is that, okay, system was good and fine, you just had to accelerate it. And what that meant for nuclear industry was that a few months before the explosion, they adopted new targets for the next five-year plan. And those targets suggested that the construction of the nuclear reactors was supposed to be more than doubled in the next 5 years. And one of the ways to do that was to cut the time that was basically needed for the construction of those reactors by 2 years. So they were really looking for these reserves. They were cutting corners, and eventually that is what led to the explosion, in a sense that the reactor that they used at Chernobyl, it was maybe much cheaper than other type of reactors that they were exporting to Eastern Europe. It was also much more powerful, but it was also more dangerous. So it was the so-called water graphite reactor, where graphite was used for moderation of the reactor, of the reaction. And graphite was something that eventually caught fire after the explosion took place. And most of the radiation that was released because of this graphite burning inside of the reactor that by that time was unsealed. It was opened. You mentioned that the amount of the radiation that was released is equivalent to 500 Hiroshima-type bombs, which is absolutely true. But interesting that it was only 5% of the reactor fuel that escaped.
Mm.
And that caused that kind of damage, environmental damage, and certainly a number of people were killed immediately. Then people died after the explosion, and the health of people was affected far away from Chernobyl, including in countries of Central Europe.
Mm. It's interesting too, in this chapter where you set the stage, you talk about Viktor Bryukhanov, the 50-year-old
right.
director of the Chernobyl nuclear power station. He is interviewed in early March by a reporter from Kyiv, and in his comments about the power plant, he told the reporter a few words of warning. We must hope that this will also promote greater attention to the reliability and safety of atomic energy generation at our Chernobyl station in particular. That is most urgent for us. That word of warning was left out of what was published in the newspaper. So in a sense, that conspiracy of silence when it came to Chernobyl and concerns about it was already in place even before the disaster occurred.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was in place, and one of the reasons for that was that the nuclear energy as a whole, whether you talk about nuclear arms or you talk about the nuclear power plants, that was considered to be a top secret part of the Soviet industry. So even the design of the reactor was unknown outside of the Soviet Union. The people who were involved in building of those reactors were people, the very same people who built the first Soviet atomic bomb and also the first Soviet hydrogen bomb. Scientific advisor to the group that designed the reactor was Anatoly Alexandrov, who was at that time the president of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, director of the Institute of Nuclear Energy. Another major figure in that story is Yefim Slavsky, who was the uncrowned king of the Soviet nuclear industry. He stayed in the office of the minister responsible for that branch of Soviet industry since late 1950s. So those were the pioneers in the Soviet atomic and nuclear project, and they were also the ones who were overseeing or in one way or another involved in the production of electrical energy. And the kind of the culture that they brought with them was, okay, just let's do it. The sacrifice is okay, safety is secondary. And again, that kind of ethos was created in the late 40s and early 50s when the idea was, okay, in the Soviet Union, that they were supposed to catch up with the United States, whatever is the cost.
Mm.
And those were the same people who brought that safety culture or lack of safety culture to the Soviet civic nuclear industry.
Right. And you describe, and it's really interesting to read, of the kind of pressure that they were under to launch reactors by particular dates. And often it would be before the end of a given calendar year, because
right.
Then the party leaders could sort of crow about this accomplishment which had occurred during the year. And so there's this very arbitrary sense of when things should happen, even if they really could happen. And you tell us Bryukhanov was in a difficult position. He was the one who had to sign papers attesting to satisfactory completion of the work, but Bryukhanov was responsible for the operational soundness and safety of the units. The problem was that the government was at once contractor and client.
Exactly.
And I think you're telling us that because of that sort of double presence in the mix, nobody was taking ultimate responsibility for the safety of all this.
This is basically essential because, again, my book talks about the dangers of nuclear industry as a whole, but it also points to differences that existed back then, certainly between the Soviet nuclear industry and the nuclear industry in Europe and in the United States. And one of key differences was that it was the governor, the government that was the party that was building the reactors, that was just accepted the reactors in operation, set in the targets, production targets, and also responsible for safety. And this is an impossible situation that sooner or later would have to lead to some kind of a major catastrophe. And there were a number of the accidents before that. One of them took place in 1957 in the Ural Mountains at the Kishtym side, and that's where the tank of the radioactive elements exploded. That was the facility that produced plutonium and enriched uranium for the Soviet nuclear bombs. They had to resettle some villages. They were successful in cover up of the whole thing. It didn't become known until the fall of the Soviet Union. And then at the nuclear power plants, an accident that in its core, in terms of its science, was more or less the same as a Chernobyl. Took place in 1975 at the nuclear power plant near the city of St. Petersburg, Russia. Back then it was, of course, called Leningrad. So the physics of the accident was the same, but the consequences were different. So it was much, much on a smaller rate. But again, that was the warning sign that was completely ignored.
Right. This is really a case of a situation, a setting, a scenario in which, in a sense, it is impossible to learn from history, from the mistakes of history. And
especially when you don't want to learn. And the reasons why they didn't want to learn was that meant, first of all, a loss of prestige for some of these key figures in the Soviet industrial complex. And second, that would involve enormous amount of money to, let's say, decommission the reactors that were not good and build another ones. And they thought that they couldn't afford it. So there was not just inability to learn from history, but there was no desire to do that.
We're speaking with Sergei Plokhy about his book Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. The second chapter of the book is absolutely riveting. It's titled Inferno. And this is, of course, when you describe the unfolding of the disaster itself. And I think we will not take the time to talk through this. It's really, I think, best read by our listeners. But I'm just astonished at all that you tell us. In a very brief nutshell, can you first tell us if we know exactly what went wrong at Chernobyl and why? And I ask that question because one of the most striking things about your description of the catastrophe itself is that all kinds of people who perhaps should have known what went wrong didn't. They seemed completely mystified and completely surprised that this had occurred. And I just wonder, to what extent is it clear all these years later what happened and why it happened?
Well, you're absolutely right. The operators whose actions caused the explosion, or at least made it possible, were really, really at loss. They first of all, couldn't accept psychologically that the reactor exploded because they didn't think that it was possible at all. And second, they couldn't understand what could lead to the explosion. So many of them died weeks after that. Still, basically, their main concern at that time was not their personal safety, but they were trying to figure out what happened. And there was this kind of a crushing sense of guilt for what they did, but they didn't understand what really caused the explosion. Today, I would say that there is a consensus overall of that the explosion happened for two separate sets of reasons. The first were the problems with the design of the reactor, and that's the first sign that there were problems. Happened, as I said already, in 1975 at the Leningrad power station. It was, first of all, not safe because of the graphite. But second, the reaction in the core of the reactor, the nuclear reaction, was moderated, or it was possible to shut it down with the help of the special rods made out of boron. And once they move into the active zone, they absorb the neutrons and they shut down the reactor or slow it down. And one of the problems with the design of the reactor was that the tips of those rods were made, again, out of graphite. And when graphite was moving into the active zone, the immediate reaction was actually the spike in the intensity of the nuclear reaction. And that was one of the reasons that led to the explosion. It took place when they pressed the emergency shutdown button, the so-called AZ-5 button, and instead of shutting down, the reactor exploded. But another thing was, of course, that the operators themselves, they violated all sorts of rules, and because there was this myth about the safety of the reactor that was shared by everyone in the industry and was also shared by political leadership. Gorbachev, when he was interviewed about Chernobyl and about his first reaction to the news, he said that he was basically astonished. He was surprised. He couldn't believe what he heard, because he said Alexandrov, the president of the Academy of Sciences, assured all of us that they were as safe as samovar, that you can put it in the middle of the Red Square, nothing would happen. So there was a lot of kind of a disbelief and certainly lack of understanding of what happened.
Right. And what we read, in fact, there's a small chapter in this section called Inferno called titled Denial, in which we see this play out again and again, even when there is incontrovertible evidence. Over and over again, we see the words, he refused to admit it, or he refused to believe it, that one of the reactors had been, in fact, destroyed. And what one person used to sum this up with, mass blindness. Many see what has happened but do not believe it. And, of course, in this case, that was a crucial mistake. I think one of the most striking things about this section of the book is when you describe what was going on in this small community not far from the power plant, where you tell us, for instance, that as this disaster was unfolding, there were seven weddings going on in this community and real life going on as it always had. Explain how finally the citizens of this community began to realize that something was amiss at the power plant.
Well, the first people who realized that something was terribly wrong were the firefighters. So those were the people who really were the first there at the power plant once the alarm sounded, and they thought that they were just dealing with regular fire. They never were trained to deal with the anything related to radiation. The doctors in the hospital where eventually those people would be delivered had no clue what radiation was and how to deal with that. And this is part of this, again, big belief in reactors don't explode. They started to realize that was not a regular fire. Maybe 20 minutes into the process, when they suddenly were not able to act the way how they acted, that they felt nausea, they were vomiting, that they were losing their strength. It was extremely difficult for them to get from the roof of the reactor and the machine hall where they were fighting fire. And once they were delivered to the hospital and doctors still didn't know what was going on, what they told their relatives or wives, those were all young men, once those relatives visited them, just pack everything and leave. So the first to leave Pripyat, the town that was next to the power plant, were the families of the firefighters. So those firefighters who still had some strength, they were taking their families and bringing somewhere else. But it took the commission that was specifically created to deal with the disaster, the state commission, government commission, more than 24 hours to decide that they have to evacuate the city as a whole. And according to the instructions and regulations and rules and laws that were in place at that time in the Soviet Union, they were supposed to do that immediately. But that was a political decision that no one actually dared to make. So eventually it was the head of the Soviet government, Nikolai Ryzhkov, in Moscow who had had to be consulted and who gave his approval for evacuation of the city. And while all of that was happening, again, there was zero information to the citizens, and the weddings were going on, and children were playing on the streets. I make reference to that footage, the film, documentary film. There are just a few minutes in my book, but it's available on YouTube, where you see that the city is living its normal life at the time when there are already police on the streets, where they're washing streets with water. And you look at the footage, and there are these sparks on the film, and the sparks come from these radiation particles.
Hmm.
So it's really surreal. But you also see women dressed, and it was very warm, nice spring weather. Women dressed in summer dresses, and children really in their shorts. It's really surreal. And
right.
Again, I certainly encourage your listeners not to maybe not only to read the book, but also just Google that and go on YouTube and see that with their own eyes. It is surreal scene.
In this chapter called Exodus, you write, for 36 hours after the explosion, people were given no reliable information about it and virtually left on their own. They were never provided with instructions on how to protect themselves and their children. Ultimately, more than 1,000 buses come into this community, and I keep sort of referring it to as a community. In fact, 50,000 people lived there. 50,000 people were ultimately evacuated, and so this was no small matter. And, of course, ultimately, in addition to that task, was also the task of trying to contain the damage at the Chernobyl power plant and to prevent an even greater catastrophe from occurring. What was the greatest fear about the power plant? What could have gone wrong that would have made this an even worse catastrophe?
Well, we already talked the operators, the engineers, really couldn't understand why it exploded. And then once people with, again, the scientists came from Moscow, from Kiev, from other places, and the commission was formed, they still couldn't figure out, first of all, the causes of the explosion, and then they didn't know what was going inside the reactor. So they were the evacuation of the city of Pripyat was happening very interestingly, not because they believed that the radiation levels were high and dangerous for the citizens of the city. They were, but that wasn't the reason why they evacuated. They evacuated because they expected another explosion of the reactor. And that was the key reason, and that kind of a possibility was with everyone who was working there for another maybe 2 weeks, up until maybe May 9th or May 10th of 1986. So the explosion took place on April 26th. So up until May 9th or 20th, they were still expecting a new explosion and silently making preparations for the evacuation of the city of Kyiv that was in excess of 1 million people. You said 50,000 people in Pripyat, a lot.
Yes.
Yes, a lot, but think about the city between 1 and 2 million people in Kyiv. So the Gorbachev, I don't remember anymore whether I mentioned that or not, but he addressed the nation on the issue of Chernobyl only 18 days after the explosion, which is, sounds very strange, especially by Western standards, but was not so strange by Soviet standards.
Right. Another point you make that I think is so important, and I think is something I'd certainly never considered until I read this in your book, is that the Soviet government might very well have attempted to contain this event, I mean, to cloak it in secrecy even longer, if Chernobyl had been located someplace else, perhaps right in the middle of the Soviet Union. But the fact that Chernobyl was much closer to its western boundary, in closer proximity to northern and central Europe, meant that this information, this disaster, could not be contained any more than the radiation released from Chernobyl could be contained. So this made it an unprecedented catastrophe.
Exactly, exactly. And basically the first accident of the maybe comparable proportions took place in 1957, but it was Ural Mountains. It was in the middle of the Soviet Union, so the radiation or significant amount of radiation didn't spread beyond the borders of the USSR, and that's why it was possible to keep it under wraps. But Chernobyl was a different story, and the first to sound the alarm were people in Sweden. At the nuclear power plant there, they thought that something was wrong with their nuclear plant. And only after that, the Soviets started to release information, just one bit after another, and under enormous pressure from the West and the United States in particular. Gorbachev was upset by that when he addressed the nation. We talked about that a few minutes ago. One-third of his speech was basically dedicated to the attacks on the West that apparently or allegedly there was just unfair treatment of the Soviet government by the Western government. So it was, the Cold War was still there, the nuclear energy was secret, and then it was a major blow to the prestige of the Soviet Union. So they were really, really reluctant and then slow to release the information. But eventually they had to do that, and that was the beginning of really Gorbachev's reform. The first of them was called glasnost, or openness. And it's impossible for me to imagine glasnost happening without this first stage of glasnost, the information about Chernobyl that was forced on the Soviet government by the Western pressure, but also by the kind of internal revolt within the country. People needed information, wanted information, and the first mobilization against the government was happening around those issues.
Well, for all that we have explored in the last few minutes, I want to make clear that we have in some ways just scratched the surface. Your book explores so many more details about many other facets of this disaster, including very interesting information about how the evacuations were carried out, in particular the difficulties that were faced by Ukrainian officials to try to protect people and help them without telling them too much about what was going on. Your book also explores the efforts to ultimately contain the damage, and also explores some of the punishment that was meted out, including 10-year prison terms to some of the top officials at this Chernobyl power plant for what had occurred. It is a huge story, and I commend you for telling it so thoroughly and in such compelling fashion. The book, again, is Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. It is published by Basic Books. It includes a number of very, very interesting and, I should say, disturbing photographs that also help to bring this story to life. The author, Serhii Plokhii. Professor Plokhii, thank you so much for making time in your schedule to talk about your fascinating book. And thank you for sharing this story.
Thanks a lot for having me. Thank you.
Mr. Plokhii, through the course of this interview, made reference to some interesting videos that can be viewed on YouTube. I asked him later to say exactly what those videos are. He would direct you to a video titled Pripyat, The Last Day. Pripyat is spelled P-R-I-P-Y-A-T. Pripyat, The Last Day. And also Ghost Town of Pripyat, Summer 1986. Both easily found on YouTube. Tomorrow on the morning show, author Peter Stark talking about his latest book, which is called Young Washington. It explores some of the ways in which George Washington was shaped into the iconic heroic figure that he eventually became and whom we know so well. But very early on, he was a young, impulsive man who made all kinds of mistakes, especially during the French and Indian War.